Welcome back to Killer Fun, where we explore the intersection of crime and entertainment every other week. I'm Christy.
And I'm Jackie.
And we're so glad that you're back with us today. Today, we are talking The Talented Mr. Ripley. We're giving Patricia Highsmith a do-over. So we did not enjoy the adaptation of her book, The Blunderer.
Yes, as I recall it, you specifically said a kind of boring.
Yes, because it was. But this is the first in her Ripley series, and it got a delightful adaptation in 1999 with a cast really kind of at the beginning of storied careers. They had done things, but they were still kind of near the beginning of their careers.
They were new.
They were still very fresh-faced.
Were they fresh-faced.
Delightfully okay. So.
I remember having a lot of opinions about Jude Law when I was back in 1999.
Oh, in the 90s, Jude Law. I was like, Josh, he might have to go on my list.
On my list. Yes. Well, we got to see a lot of Jude Law in this movie, which I did not know was going to happen. I remembered exactly nothing about this movie. I think this was kind of the type of movie that I saw when we just chose to go to the movies and pick a movie. And right. So between like the soda, the snow caps, and like the popcorn munching, I don't think I paid that much attention to.
Okay.
I don't know why, because I feel like I should have been very excited about what occurred here. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, I'm sorry.
Oh, we're going to get into it.
We're going to get there. But I remembered exactly nothing about this movie.
Really?
And so, I mean, I remember seeing it, but it was like watching them for the first time.
Yeah. Oh, that's fun.
Yeah. So
that's fun.
Fresh Face Boys.
Okay. So we watched this maybe a lot in 99, 2000, like when it first hit HBO.
Mm.
I think we watched it a few times, but I sat down to watch it and my husband happened to be in the room because I'm kind of annoying to watch the movies with when I'm preparing for this. Because I take a lot of notes because I'm like, interesting, or what's going to happen? I want to be able to remember what happens at what point. And I'll go back through those notes and I'll be like, ooh, that's an interesting thing. Is that real? Is that true? Ooh, that's an interesting psychological thing that maybe I want to look into a little more. So when I do my research, so I'm kind of annoying. It took me like, this is a movie. It's a long movie.
It is a long movie.
It's like 2 hours and 10 minutes, 2 hours, 20 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
It's long, over 2 hours. But there is no grass growing underneath these stones of this movie. It's fine. It's got a good pacing despite its length. But it probably took me 3.5 hours to watch this movie.
Oh, man. Yeah, that would be hard.
Yeah. So, but we're sitting there and he looks at it and he goes, I don't remember that happening at all. Wow, did you remember that? Like, nope. So it was kind of...
How did we miss this before?
Well, because I wasn't paying attention. I read books and watch movies differently than I used to. Now that we do this kind of thing with it.
I know, but I mean, I wasn't taking notes because I'm a visual and auditory learner.
And you...
So I listen and learn, and I can watch something and learn. So I'm not a big note taker.
Mm-hmm.
I do a lot of task lists, and I have a whole dirty side of me with that. But so I was just, watching and hanging out. And I was like, oh.
Yes. What? So you retain it better than I do. If I write it down, I retain it. But I'm one of those that I need to take all the notes in the class because if I write it down, I can remember it.
Yeah.
But if I don't write it down.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, I didn't remember anything, so it was very interesting to go back and look at this. And Jude Law and Matt Damon were so young, and then Gwyneth Paltrow, so young. Oh my gosh, it was crazy, but I thought it held up well.
I thought it held up really well, too. That's kind of the nice thing about a period piece.
Yeah, true.
You know, is you don't have to worry about the technology getting in the way.
Right.
They didn't have iPhones in 1999 or 1958.
Right, exactly. So it didn't matter.
So you didn't have to worry about the technology.
I know, but even some of the tropes that period pieces can fall into, but all movies can fall into. I just didn't feel its age.
No, it held up really, really well.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It had a screenwriter, director who had a real love of the material, and it really just couldn't help but be hints. So let's talk about that screenwriter, director, and then briefly I'm just going to say who's in it and what part they're playing as the cast, because we all know these people. It's a star-studded. So the director, who also wrote the screenplay, was Anthony Minghella. He also did this treatment where he wrote the screenplay and did the direction for Truly Madly Deeply, The English Patient, and Cold Mountain, which were all great movies.
Oh, yeah.
Really good movies. Tragically, in 2008, he died of a hemorrhage after complications from a surgery.
What?
Like, he had a growth or something removed from his neck, and like a week later, he hemorrhaged and died.
Oh my gosh.
But he left us quite a nice legacy with not only his work, but his son is somebody we've talked about before.
Really?
Yes.
Wait, who?
Max Minghella, who's Nick in The Handmaid's Tale.
No! Yes! No! It's his dad?
I did the same thing when I realized he had passed away, and they said the late Anthony Minghella. I was like, oh, that's sad. I have to look that up. And I was like, oh, he's Nick's dad.
Oh my gosh. That actor is so good. Uh-huh. I love him.
Yes.
He's so good. Oh, well, very good. Well, we miss you.
Yes.
We miss you, but thank you for your son.
Great movies.
Because we love him.
Mm-hmm. So Matt Damon plays Tom Ripley. Jude Law is Dickie Greenleaf. Gwyneth Paltrow is Marge. Cate Blanchett plays Meredith. Philip Seymour Hoffman is Freddie.
Oh, talk about looking at a fresh face.
Oh my gosh.
And you're like, oh my gosh, I forgot how like he was. I mean, he was just phenomenal.
Well, and he was such an interesting character because he was so like fresh faced, and you can see how he was. Freddie was magnetic, but he also saw right through Tom.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a smart, intuitive thing for him to notice immediately. And yet you didn't like him at all.
Yes. Like, yes, exactly. He's like
a good guy. Except a good guy.
Well, he has the ability to be a 1950s frat boy.
Uh-huh.
That kind of, you know, party boy fun. But he's also brooding and intelligent, but also really unlikable.
Yes.
It's really interesting. Uh-huh. He's always been amazing.
Uh-huh.
He says so much with that face.
Yes. Rest in peace.
Rest in peace.
Philip Seymour Hoffman just couldn't get away from his demons.
Mm-hmm.
Whew. But shall we recap it?
Let's recap. Boy, 2 hours and 20 minutes. Yeah. I'm going to be interested to see what you do here. I'm also interested to see what parts you include.
I'm going to try not to, like, it's a 20, almost 2-year-old film.
Yeah, we don't have to be, like, plot explanation women over right, here.
Yeah, I don't need to explain it to you that much, and I don't need to be too worried about spoiling it for you, but it's not too spoilery. So, mild-mannered Tom Ripley gets mistaken for a Princeton grad when he borrows a jacket. It seems to never occur to him to correct any assumptions. Certainly not when they're made by a rich and powerful man like Herbert Greenleaf. Herbert wishes that his own son might have the same kind of drive as Tom. But alas, darling Dickie is living lavishly in Italy with the aid of his trust fund or an allowance, something. I don't know if it's exactly a trust fund. It might just be an allowance, but seems like if daddy didn't want him to have the money, he could just cut it off. So I think it must be a trust fund. It's all very unclear.
It's all very Richie Rich Rich.
Yes. These people have a lot of money.
Richie McRicherton. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So Herbert offers Tom the, at the time, astronomical amount of $1,000 to go to Italy and convince Dickie to return to the U.S. So it's unclear how much of a plan Tom has as he plans a casual meeting with Dickie and Marge on the beach, but he's definitely up to something. He gives Dickie's name as he arrives in Italy on the boat dock. He watches the couple through binoculars to see their habits. He learns Italian and pretends not to know any. So it's not exactly on the up and up.
There's something fishy.
There's something fishy going on here. So Tom lays out his talents right away to Dickie once they're together. He's good at forging signatures, telling lies, impersonating people. And then the two men create this friendship based on a ruse of extracting additional money out of Herbert. And for months, and Tom and Dickie and Marge all grow closer and they're enjoying themselves and whatever. So Tom is privy sometimes because Dickie just doesn't care what Tom sees. And sometimes it's because Tom is really good at paying attention to what's happening around him, yeah, and what people are doing. So, but he learns that Dickie is really not at all faithful to Marge. But just as quickly as Tom was accepted into Dickie's fairy tale life, he's pushed to the side when Freddie enters the picture. Dickie and Freddie becomes the focus of Dickie's attention. So everything goes sideways for Tom after that, and almost anyone he has any kind of relationship with, it all goes sideways after that. So Tom ends up leading a double life that is magical and tenuous and exciting and lonely all at once. So Tom is clever, but no one's clever enough to keep up such a complicated life going indefinitely.
Yes. Awesome. Well done. And thank not you. Too spoilery.
Not too spoilery.
Really, I mean, obviously it's on a crime and entertainment podcast, so we know that there's some crimey stuff happening. Uh-huh. But wow. Yeah. If you haven't seen the movie, I feel like you can still go watch it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd go watch it anyway.
Because it's good.
Yeah. It's good.
It is good. Roger Ebert liked it.
Oh, good. I'm glad he did.
As he should.
He should. I would expect nothing less.
Well, exactly. Me either. Ripley, who is still developing his skills that will carry him through several more adventures, instinctively knows that the best way to lie is to admit to lying and tell the truth whenever convenient.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, yes, yes, he has learned that well. Tom Ripley seems to have feelings for Dickie Greenleaf, although narcissism and sexuality are so mixed up in his mind that Ripley almost seems to want to become Greenleaf so that he can love himself. I was that was so insightful.
That said so much that I was thinking.
Yeah.
That really kind of boiled it down, because I have so many opinions about that issue of the film. Not an issue with the film. Let me be clear.
Yeah, yeah.
That subject matter in the film. So the way that he said it, perfect.
Uh-huh. And I thought this was really interesting, too. Matt Damon is bland and ordinary as Ripley and then takes on the vivid colorization of others. I was like, oh, yeah, by himself, he's boring. Dickie tells him as much.
Oh, yeah.
You're boring. But when he's pretending to be Dickie, he is able to embody that same sort of magnetic, charismatic behavior. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't have it in and of himself, only when he's mimicking someone else.
Right. Ripley seems like, well, we'll get to this. We're going to talk about this. But Ripley does seem like someone who is in the wrong time period.
No. Okay. Okay. I look forward to you bringing that up.
Teasers. Yes.
Jude Law makes Dickie almost deserving of his fate because of the way he adopts new friends and then discards them. I'm like, he really is the victim, but there you kind of get why Tom did it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's wrong and it's know that, but you're also kind of like,
I mean,
he should have just gone back to New York, but that would have ended the movie too soon.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. It's hard to be abandoned, but, you know, by somebody. But how many of us would just prefer somebody who was that honest?
Right.
I mean, Dickie is extremely honest to a fault. He's simply someone who likes to focus on maybe one or two people at a time. And that does change because he likes excitement and life moves on. But, and that's annoying. I would count it as an annoying flaw. Maybe I don't want to be around somebody like that, but also maybe I do. maybe I'm okay with the fact that when I'm the center of attention, he really is paying attention. And mm-hmm. that can be like, okay, then when he's not paying attention, that means he's really paying attention to someone else.
Right.
Wow. Okay. Someone who actually really pays attention to the people they're with. I mean, Dickie would not have survived iPhone land.
No.
Because he needs to be there in the moment with the people.
Or he would have been an influencer by not having his own Instagram. He would have been like the Instagram prize.
Right.
I got a picture with Dickie Greenleaf.
Yeah.
And he would have liked that just as well.
Yeah, probably would have. But he wouldn't have been at the table on his iPhone.
No.
When someone else is there.
No.
That's what I mean. Like, he would not have survived this pulling of our attention to 800 different places.
That's fair.
That makes us not be in the moment and pay attention to the people that we're with. And for us, it's hard to imagine not having this ability to be with everybody. Yeah. But Dickie is, like, really paying attention to that one person. And it's kind of annoying because you get sidelined. Mm-hmm. But
you were in the sun, as Marge put it.
Yeah.
The sun was shined on him for a time, mm-hmm. and maybe a longer time than what Marge is accustomed to seeing Dickie do.
Yeah, maybe so.
Yeah.
But also, it's kind of weird. I mean, I felt like this was maybe a little bit of the weird tension in the film mm-hmm. itself. Was okay. that Freddie comes to town, and then he feels abandoned. And I'm like, well, his friend just came to town.
Yeah.
I mean, don't you always kind of go hang out with the person who just came to town to visit you?
Yeah, but he acted like a jealous boyfriend.
Exactly. Well, and that's a whole nother part of that's exactly the issue. But mm-hmm.
yeah.
But they, yeah.
Yeah.
They allowed that to be a little bit of a false tension. Like,
uh-huh.
the problem isn't that Dickie was the one who didn't pay attention to anymore, but they framed it that way.
Yeah.
The problem was that Marge and Tom were jealous.
Yeah.
Of yes. somebody who came to town.
Yeah.
Come on. You know Freddie's leaving.
Yeah.
Like next week. So.
Right.
Simmer down.
That's fair.
Yeah. It's my assessment.
Then we have The Ringer did a distance review where in 2019 it had been 20 years since the movie had come out.
Okay.
And they kind of talked about it a little bit, and I thought they had an interesting sort of take on it. Like every good melodrama, Ripley is a story dependent on misinterpreting cruelty as romance and on misreading beauty as inherently good. Just because something is superficial doesn't mean it's not deep. Minghella keeps Highsmith's thriller element, though loses the noir flair in favor of tortured love. A heist movie in slow motion, Ripley's motives reveal themselves in the moment. I was like, ooh, a heist movie in slow motion.
Yeah.
That's why it took them almost 2.5 hours to get it done.
True. It's almost like it was a long con, but that you would have to believe that Tom actually had that amount of foreplanning.
I think he had more than we realize. I think there's a lot of, because he went into it, he saw an opportunity.
Yes.
And he immediately pounced on it and, you know, learned that Dickie liked jazz and all of these different elements that he really liked. He realized as soon as he met Dickie that he would appreciate Tom's impersonation of his father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there was definitely foreplanning, but I don't know that it was as long con, which is why we see him devolve quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I think he sees the opportunity, he plans. But he also, well, he relies on his talents.
Right, yes.
In the moment.
Yes.
And so it's the chaos of the con man who has to play off of the people, who can only do so much planning because he's not really strategically thinking ahead about some things. But he's great at juggling.
Yeah, he's great at juggling. And there's only so much you can plan. He couldn't plan for Freddie.
Well, no, he couldn't.
I mean, there was no internet for him to know Freddy existed.
No, but he also overreacted because it wasn't just a long con. It was about his own insecurities, his own desires, his mm-hmm. own unhealthy frameworks of life.
That's fair.
Right? Like, yeah. like Roger Ebert kind of noted, you know, that there's this weird narcissism and this weird romance going on there, and he is not okay with any of it. But he was born in the wrong time for that.
Mm-hmm. That's okay. Now I see. As we've mentioned, the movie, The Talented Mr. Ripley, is based on a book of the same name, but they're not exactly the same. So Rubla did a comparison of the 1999 movie and the book to tell us what's different. The book tells you about Tom's upbringing.
Ooh.
Yeah, it gives a lot of backstory, which they completely leave out of the movie, which I think is wise because it kind of allows you to inhabit Tom a little bit. He's such a blank slate and so vanilla for somebody who's so talented, and he really is kind of boring on his own, and it allows you to kind of project yourself onto him. But in the book, you understand why his motives are the way they are, why he covets Dickie's lifestyle so intensely.
Yeah, you get very small hints and innuendos about it as the movie goes on, and especially towards the end as he starts to devolve and talk more. Mm-hmm. He starts to reveal little things, and you start to put together a picture. And I distinctly remember him saying, "Am I ever going to get out of this basement?" And I realized, aha, it's all starting to connect, because that scene of him running out of the basement and then getting in the chauffeured car.
Uh-huh.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Foreshadowing.
Uh-huh. Gwyneth Paltrow is a little too likable as Marge.
Oh, that, too likable.
Yeah, Tom should have found her annoying, silly, irksome.
Really?
If they portrayed her as they do in the book.
Oh.
So, and of course the book is Tom's perspective, which mostly the movie is too. But Marge was very likable in the movie and not really at all in the book.
Okay. But he says he loves her in the movie.
Yes. But I think that's only to make sure that she's not a reason that Dickie cast him out.
Okay.
I think he's a narcissist. He doesn't love her. He loves what she provides for him.
Mm.
He loves that Marge likes him well enough that she's not going to badmouth him to Dickie.
Interesting, because I kind of saw it as not a really healthy love by any stretch, but when he says that he loves her, I saw love in his own way, but like almost that he saw her as a trophy wife. That he would take her on as a trophy wife any day, and he would feel lucky to have that. Like, almost as a possession. Whereas the romance was definitely not centered on Marge.
Right.
But the status and the settling down, the marriage, the commitment and loyalty, things that he wants to value even more in his life than he really does, but wants to want to, I felt like was projected onto Marge. Like, why not me?
Yeah.
Why can't I be the one that's like marrying you? Because I can stay faithful.
Yeah.
Right. That's fair. So, I mean, not like he really loves her, because we know he loves somebody else, but
he could stay faithful and that he wouldn't sleep with another woman.
True. And you know what? Facts.
I mean.
Facts.
Yeah.
But, you know, we knew his romantic like interests lie on Dickie.
Yes, and, for sure.
You know.
Yes. So Meredith wasn't in the book at all. She was added in for the movie, and I thought she worked really, really well.
I think so.
To really kind of give, well, they say it gives Tom the chance to live Dickie's life to the letter, which I'm like, oh, yeah. Because he wanted to be somebody else.
Yeah, I thought it gave a good way to quickly also show how he's juggling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And his whole relationship with Peter, it was only an acquaintance in the book.
Oh, interesting. I would have thought that was a bigger deal.
Mm-mm. No, in the book, they were just acquaintances, but they kind of pulled that character up to kind of solidify this homosexuality.
See, and that was part of the movie that like broke my heart.
I know.
Was that he finally had actually found what he wanted to, but he was so damaged and created so much chaos that instead of it, that he was stuck. That he finally found exactly what he really wanted in somebody who was stable and kind and
who
loving.
Loved him. Yeah.
And who loved him.
And didn't find him boring or
and
vanilla.
And didn't find him boring and thought and kept asking for the quote key.
Yeah.
You know, there was that, like, give it to me. But, like, well, it's one thing to say I've had a sordid past, and there's another thing to say I've, like, killed people.
Right, yeah.
Not, this, like, I don't think Peter understood what the basement really was.
No, he didn't. No, he didn't realize, oh, Tom's a serial killer.
Yeah, like, we didn't get that. I don't think he got that. But I was so sad because I was like, oh, here he is being driven by so much oppression and confusion in a time and an age where he didn't have hardly a chance, at least in America. Mm-hmm. But in Europe, it was a little different. Not necessarily officially, but among the people, it already had begun to change. And there's Peter, who is so stable and so okay. And like, oh, he's finally found his niche. And now he has to like kill it.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, if he enters that niche, he is no more.
Right.
So he's like caused the very trouble that he's trying to avoid the whole time. So I'm so sad that that wasn't like a big piece of the book, but I'm certain that the book deals with it differently.
Yes.
I'm certain.
Well, and Patricia Highsmith was a lesbian. Mm-hmm. And so she's kind of pulling maybe from her own experience a little bit here.
I'm sure it's beautiful, the way that she writes it and pulls out the story. You know, it may be.
She is also very bigoted. So, I mean, there's really?
Oh. Wait, what? Back up.
There's a whole, I'll put on the social media, but there's a whole, like, she was not a great person. Like, her favorite thing to do was seduce married women.
Okay. Well, that's not nice.
No, it's not nice to be a racist or seduce people who are already married but she wrote great books that were well received.
Well, the talented Mrs. Patricia. That's what I have to say about that.
All right. Well, since you said that, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Is It True? Psychology Break in Real Life.
Are you ever afraid to talk about something? Do you avoid certain topics, maybe with certain people? Like your racist Uncle Frank. Sorry, Frank, it's true. Do you want to learn how to have better conversations, increase compassion, and build bridges, not walls? We Don't Talk About That with Lucas Land is the podcast where we do talk about that with me, Lucas Land. Get it wherever fine podcasts can be found.
So here's how it works. Christy wrecks her search history. Hey, NSA, we promise it's nothing more nefarious than a podcast. To find out what's true, some of the psychological motivations behind the character's actions, and real-life applications that relate to our topic. I have no idea what Christy decided to look up. Could be the same thing that captured my curiosity or something I never thought of.
All right, is it true? So Herbert Greenleaf provides Tom travel to Italy on an ocean liner.
Yes, it was the Queen Mary, wasn't it?
Well, it was Cunard Shipping Lines, which is real.
Oh, yes. Well, because the boat went by and it said Queen Mary.
Yes,
and
that's... yes, that's some of their flagship boats. Yes. Very, very fancy luxury cruise line.
Right. It was basically the ones that didn't sink.
Yeah. Yeah.
How fun would that be? I think that would be fun. I would not like that.
I probably wouldn't, but would I have preferred that to go to Europe in 1958? Probably.
Yeah.
I might have preferred that over flying.
This is stupid. I'm trying to think, can you even get there by flight? I'm sure you can.
Yeah, you probably have to fly. Well, boy, already in New York. You could probably make it to London
Probably could make it to London.
Maybe Paris.
Yeah.
But then you'd have to find a way from there.
But flying was so much nicer then, too.
Well, like it was true. Everybody dressed up and
more room in the seats. But the technology was a little...
I mean, but beautiful.
But beautiful. This ship was gorgeous.
Yes.
See, shipping, we've been doing that for a lot longer than flying. I probably wouldn't want to take that 1958, too.
Uh-huh, yep. So, Mangibello?
Mangibello.
Mangibello is fictional.
Oh, it's such a pretty name.
It is. It's a really lovely name. Tourism Review talks about how you have to go to see a fictional place where it was really filmed.
Okay.
So, both the 1999 version of The Talented Mr. Ripley and an earlier version of The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Oh, I did not know this.
We didn't know because it's a French film.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Interesting.
Yes. And they're different enough. They interpret the story different enough and tell different parts of it that they're really like different movies.
Oh my gosh.
But and even some of the character names are different. But it's based on Patricia Highsmith's book. But it was called Plein Soleil, which is Purple Moon.
Okay.
And both films were filmed on location in Italy on the same island.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What island?
It's Ischia.
Okay.
I-S-C-H-I-A. Ischia. Yeah.
Or Ischia.
Yeah, no, I...
Did you look it up? Oh, of course you did. You have it written out phonetically, don't you?
Ischia.
Ischia.
Uh-huh. Yes, okay. And it's a volcanic island in the Bay of Naples, about 30 kilometers. So Ooh. It was really an island. I mean, you couldn't really get there by bus.
Right, you have to take a boat.
Yeah, we would have to take a ferry. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure they have buses on the island. But I thought it was interesting that they chose to both use the same gorgeous, lovely island.
Gorgeous.
It's so beautiful.
Mangibello. I love it. Mangi. That's what I loved about it, was that they had this little short uh-huh. cute name. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's very similar to like Gilmore Girls with Stars Hollow.
Uh-huh.
It's such a perfect Connecticut town, but Stars Hollow doesn't exist.
Right.
Right? But yes. You can go to the town where it was based off of, and it's like, oh my gosh, this is exactly it.
This is Stars Hollow.
Like,
yes.
This is it.
But Cortina, on the other hand, this is where Dickie and Marge and a whole group of their trust funders in their 20s had planned to spend Christmas. Very much a real place. Very much for skiing.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very luxurious for the jet set and Italian aristocratic crowd. Ooh. Sorry, aristocratic. Just would not come out there for a second.
No, every time I say the word whatever, all I can say is aristocrat.
Yes! Yes, so it's a beautiful, skiing, wintry, lovely place. So it's real. Even if Mangibello is not.
Okay. So, well, they might as well be fake. I'm never going to get there.
Well.
So.
And that's fine. Because really, what would I do? Probably enjoy the lovely vistas and drink espresso.
Yeah.
Because I'm probably not getting on skis.
I don't know that I would do that again.
Okay.
I did it once when I was younger, uh-huh. and it was not easy.
No, it's not easy, and I'm fairly clumsy. So it's no secret that we like our coffee here on Killer Fun. But that coffee maker was like so fancy and modern looking.
For that day and age. Ooh.
But it was like a real thing. That would have been period. Yes. I was like, good job.
I got that right. I was very confident.
Oh, yes. Because the piston driven, which is the kind that they had at his lovely villa that he was renting. It was developed in Italy in 1945. So definitely could have had that. And it definitely would have cost a lot of money.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
So since Mangibello is fictional, so was the festival.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So there was the lovely festival where, unfortunately, the Dickie's lover's body washed up, and we find out she was pregnant, and it was this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but that ceremony might have been based on a couple of different ones.
Okay, yeah, because that was the director nailed this whole scene.
Uh huh.
Because when that statue came out the water, I thought, what is happening? Like, it really jarred me, and then they all started walking out, and I was like, what is happening right now? And then, of course, they pieced it together, but they got my attention.
Uh-huh. Loved it. But there isn't one exactly like that, but there is one in the middle of August Madonna della Madia.
Okay.
Basically, it marks the end of summer. There's a very holiday style atmosphere. And on the 15th of August that she arrives by boat.
Okay.
But then,
Not out of the water,
but she arrives by boat and she arrives and she's a painting.
Okay.
It's not a statue, but there's another one that typically happens at the end of the year, Pio del Cine. And this one it celebrates the finding of a Madonna statue in the water. So,
oh, okay.
It's medium.com. The legend tells about a wooden statue of the Virgin Mary found floating by some fishermen in the sea waters. The statue had a very heavy marble base and the men could not manage to take it out of the water. A group of small children with the delicate touch of their hands managed to take the statue ashore and the village people decided to dedicate the church to the Holy Mary.
Oh, cool.
So I think it's kind of maybe a combination of things.
Right.
And it made for good cinema. To have it come out of the water.
Like how they walked underneath the water with it and then had it rise.
Yeah.
Like, that was super cool.
Yeah. It was really cool. And, you know, it's a lot of, and that put them in the water to be able to find the body and all of that stuff. It was really good. Opera.
Oh, that opera scene was gorgeous.
Wasn't it beautiful?
Magnificent.
I was like, wow, it's snowing on stage. The guy gets shot
in the blood.
Was the pulled out cape. Yes.
And how it kept growing and the lighting fabric was just perfect to make it. Oh,
it was beautiful. Beautiful. It's a real opera.
Mm-hmm.
Eugene Onegin. And it's... Actually, the story is very germane. They did a good job of pulling that in to this particular one. The story concerns a selfish hero who lives to regret his blasé rejection of a young woman's love and his careless incitement of a fatal duel with his best friend.
Mm-hmm.
Like, mm-hmm, yeah.
I have to admit, though, in our day and age, that first scene where they get the guns and stuff, I wanted to be like, Hamilton!
Yes, exactly.
Not at all.
No, not at all.
Not at all.
When Tom is brought in to be questioned about Dickie's disappearance by the Italian police, Tom once again feigns no understanding of Italian.
Oh, yes,
so that Peter might be able to help him.
Yeah.
And the detective outright asks if Tom is gay.
Right.
Yeah. Is he homosexual? And he says, for the record, no Italians are homosexual.
Peter says that, doesn't he?
Yeah, Peter says that. No Italian is homosexual. And that makes Leonardo and Michelangelo inconvenient.
I love that line. I love Peter's line.
You're so good. Oh, Peter's, I would say, by far the most likable character in the entire movie.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I want to be Peter's friend.
I love Peter. He's great.
I loved Peter. But Leonardo da Vinci was almost certainly gay.
Okay.
He didn't really make any reference to his personal life and the thousands of documents and artwork that he left behind. So there's been a lot of speculation about that. There is a historical document that shows that Leonardo was accused of sodomy in 1476. And that was very serious offense at the time. But it was also, because it was so serious and carried the death penalty, it was also difficult to prove, because if they were going to hand down the death penalty, they wanted to make sure that they were completely right. And simply saying, one man saying he sodomized me to another man was not enough proof. Okay, that's pretty good. And in Florence, it was sufficiently widespread, homosexuality, that it was generally accepted in the 1400s. That they generally didn't hand down this very much because it was, as you said, very open in Europe. They've had a lot less of an issue for a much longer time. A contemporary biographer, Vasari, who was near contemporary to Leonardo da Vinci, wrote a biography shortly after Leonardo lived. And he made basically no reference to his sexuality whatsoever. But there's a couple of schools of thought. Some historians believe that the accusation of sodomy and that there was a formal accusation of it really scared Leonardo and made him live his life as a celibate man.
Okay.
In order to not run afoul of the law. And then there are others that said, no, no, he wasn't celibate. He was just much more careful.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I can understand why.
Yeah.
I mean, death penalty.
Yeah. You want to be really careful?
I mean, oh, I have so many questions. Oh, okay. Well, did they persecute? I say persecute, and I meant that. But I should say prosecute. Persecute individuals who are heterosexual?
Yeah. Who, yeah. No, they did not, I'm sure.
Yeah.
These it was only.
And that's why it's persecution and not prosecution of the law. That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
I digress.
But, and Michelangelo was much bolder about it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of visual and written evidence. He was absolutely a homosexual man.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, it's hard to look back in this, how do I say, this day and age with our not really quite 2020, which should be 2020 vision.
Right.
On that day and age, because we're really not out of it yet. We're not really out of it yet, but Europe was so much more sensual in general. Like, all their interactions are more sensual. Mm-hmm. And so it does. It makes it, I guess, a little less confusing for those there to deal with the subject, and more confusing for people from, like, the West or, you know, from America to go there and experience it, because the sensuality there is not necessarily connected to romance all the time. And our culture just is so different. It's like oil and water in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially in the 50s too.
Oh, especially in the 50s.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been the type of relationship that Tom maybe wouldn't have ever seen.
Right. Well, and I don't think Tom was ever prepared for a friendship that had a sensual, and I say that word sensual, and I don't mean sexual.
Right.
A more sensual expression of friendship.
Right.
And how that doesn't necessarily mean leading to the next thing.
Right.
And how that's not weird.
Psychology break.
Psychology break.
Man, Dickie had a lot of animosity for his dad.
Ooh, he did. Yeah, daddy issues. Except he didn't have daddy money issues. So,
no.
Okay.
He was perfectly happy to take dad's money. Psychology Today had a article, 4 ways to release anger toward parents.
Ooh, this is interesting.
So
okay.
I was kind of thinking about Dickie as I was reading this article. So some of the causes of this lifelong anger might be physical or emotional neglect from parents. Mm-hmm. Possible, especially in a wealthy family like that. Parents expect too much from a child or were excessively controlling. That would make sense.
Mm-hmm.
A consequence. Now, of course, there's a lot of other things. I only picked out the ones I thought kind of related to Dickie.
Right.
Yeah. So some of the consequences might be emotionally unavailable as adults and therefore unable to sustain intimate relationships.
Mm.
Now, he could sustain an intimate relationship with Marge, basically with the understanding that she knew he was going to cheat. Mm-hmm. And he was going to have these other intense relationships outside of their relationship. But she kind of didn't care as long as she got to be
in the
orbit all the time.
Right.
She was okay not being the one always in the sun as long as she was one always in the orbit.
Right. Like, she just accepted him for who he was.
Yeah.
And it was more stable. Like, they were a home base for each other.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yes. But he wouldn't have put up with her not being faithful.
Oh, I don't think so. And that may have been cultural at the time, or it may not have been, but it is hard to, you know, disentangle that when you're looking at 1958, even across the world with gender.
Yeah.
Yes, as freer as maybe Europe was in some ways, there's still those gender expectations in some way.
Yeah. So they have 4 things that they suggest that you do. I would say Dickie didn't really struggle with any of these, and yet he still harbored a lot of anger.
Okay.
So acknowledge your anger.
Oh, he acknowledged it. That's true.
He did. Talk about the hurt. Oh, he talked about it with anybody who'd listen.
Yep.
Set boundaries with your parents. I would say moving to Italy is a pretty clear boundary.
Yeah. Pretty clear.
And love yourself and believe in your worthiness. Like, Dickie didn't have any problems believing in himself. But if you're struggling with it, maybe those things will help you.
Fair.
Secrets are detrimental to us, but maybe not in the way that we would first think of. So Scientific American had an article, Why the Secrets You Keep Are Hurting You.
Ooh, interesting. Yeah. Okay.
And so they kind of talk about how it can be detrimental to intimate relationships. It can be bad for your health to keep secrets. Keeping a secret is difficult. It's hard work. You have to watch what you say. You try and not slip up. It might require you to engage in deception. You have to be constantly vigilant in it. But that's not really, those aren't the things that hurt you.
Okay.
When you have your secret. What really hurts you is the idea that you keep it and you hide it and you think about it all the time.
So it's like taxing your mental attention.
Yes. Yes. That when you think about the secret that you're keeping, mm-hmm. it makes you feel inauthentic to other people because you know that the people around you don't know something.
Gotcha.
And that causes you to feel inauthentic within yourself. And that it can make you feel isolated and alone.
Yeah.
In addition to being difficult, but those difficulties wouldn't be so difficult if we didn't feel isolated and alone and inauthentic ourselves. Which that is why narcissists tend to be good at it, because they don't feel bad about it.
Right. There's not that remorse.
Right.
That guilt or that weariness of feeling like an imposter or, mm-hmm. yeah.
Exactly.
And there is a difference also, I think, between secrets and privacy.
Right.
Like there's parts of yourself that you should be private about. And sometimes you have to be wise about who and when you share that. And for some time, you might go through a season where there's not somebody in your life that you can share with in a mm-hmm. safe way. And it ends up being a secret and kind of eating you up. But, you know, it also doesn't mean that you need to go shout all your basement stuff Mm-mm. to everyone either.
Right.
Like, that's not going to be helpful either. So, like, you have to be kind of wise about how you deal with it. Mm-hmm. And now I've got a song in my head. I hear the secrets that you keep. All
right. Now, Tom said, insightfully said that people believe themselves to be, that people don't believe themselves to be bad.
Yeah, he said that. Uh-huh. And I kind of was like,
Yeah. Well, we'll swing back around to that.
Okay.
We'll get there next. But, Parker Molly wrote an article for Medium.com. Nobody thinks they're a villain and I don't believe in evil, which I don't know that I agree on the evil part, but she has this whole like interesting kind of thought experiment that she does with people don't think they're evil.
Okay.
So she quotes philosopher Mary Wollstonecraft. No man chooses evil because it is evil. He only mistakes it for happiness, the good he seeks. Which I'm like, oh, that's kind of interesting. They don't really think that they're being bad. So then she talks about somebody whom she feels is a villain who doesn't know he's a villain.
Ooh, okay. All right.
It's a little political.
Okay.
But I'm just going to say, she sees this person as a villain and he doesn't see himself as a villain. So she's talking about David French, who writes for the National Review. You see where this is going, right? Uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh. So he writes a lot about how people in the United States are trying to destroy religious liberty. I'm with you on that eye roll. On the topic of same-sex couples being able to adopt, this is what David French had to say. The quote-unquote discriminatory Christian agencies aren't actually blocking gay adoptions. Gay couples looking to adopt or foster children just have to seek out one of the many secular organizations willing to serve them. Okay. And then on accommodations for sexual orientation and gender when it comes to marriage.
Okay.
He had to say, no gay couple in America has been denied a photographer, a florist, or a baker. In a handful of cases where Christian business owners declined to participate in the same-sex weddings, plenty of other vendors were willing to step in. Kim Davis could not block a single gay person from getting married. Frustrated gay couples could drive a short distance and get a marriage license from any neighboring county. Okay? So Then Parker Molly has this to say. See, it's not discrimination because, wait, why? Because the end, fulfilling God's will, I guess, justifies disparate treatment. French almost certainly doesn't think of himself as evil, nor does he think that of Kim Davis, photographers, florists, or bakers. He's framed this as clear-cut good versus evil proposition in which the responsibility of the good, religious conservatives, to defeat the evil, gay people.
Oh, see.
And I
get it, because if you've read a lot of David French, and I have not read a lot, but I've read a decent amount, because mm-hmm. I think it's healthy to read people who are talking about other points of view.
Yeah.
And he's one I can at least tolerate as far as the way he writes.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting she chose him.
Uh-huh.
Because of anybody, I might have the most compassion, even if I don't agree and I think that he's totally wrong.
Yeah.
Because there are some things he says that he tries to root it in something. So it's very interesting she chose him.
Yeah.
Because I think he's what we would think of maybe as like a colorblind racist.
Uh-huh.
Right? Yeah. He's the one who is that guy. And if you don't know all about colorblind racism, we can talk about that later. Anyways, the point being that in his argument, though, he makes the point that it's okay because our evil efforts failed.
Yeah, yeah.
Wait, what? So we're saying that, like, it's okay for Hitler to be Hitler if he hadn't succeeded at it.
Right. He lost the war.
So
it's kind of okay.
It's kind of okay.
Yeah.
That's the exact argument he made. Well, we tried all of this stuff to keep people from getting married, and see, it didn't work. Uh-huh. So there's nothing wrong. How does that work?
Yeah.
Again?
Yeah.
You tried to kill me, but you know, you failed. So it's all good, buddy. No harm, no foul. Like, No. If somebody tries to kill you, we still prosecute that.
Right, yeah.
Attempted murder.
Yeah.
Attempted. Just because it's an attempt doesn't make it, because the intent is still there.
Right.
And he doesn't deal with intent. He deals with outcome only.
Right.
He's outcome based. And then he makes his judgments based on the outcome.
Right. Instead of saying it was wrong for Kim Davis to deny those mm-hmm. people something that has been afforded to them by the federal government.
Yes. Do you know what it is? It's prosperity gospel. It's outcome based. If your faith is completely based on what the outcome was, then you can always justify the means and you can always justify yourself, because the outcome does tend to work out in general. And so you can always sort of, and if it works out good for you, then you just get this positive reinforcement.
Right.
Right. And that's how you keep it from being about your character.
Right.
And doing things that, like integrity, you know, doing the right thing when nobody's looking, uh-huh. right, stuff. Instead, yeah. it's mm-hmm. all.
Yeah.
I'm making sound effects today.
That's fine.
But okay, my question for the author, though, is that does she have compassion for who he is and where he is in his journey? Or does she use it? Because that's, I think, where we all end up, is how do we use compassion in a situation like this?
Well, let me read you one more quote from her article then. But the point I'm trying to make is that so long as we look at the world through the lens of objective good versus objective evil, we'll never truly be able to understand why anyone does anything.
Good. So she does.
Yes.
She has that compassion.
Right.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. Well, she said in the article title, I don't believe in evil.
Right. And that's why I wanted to know what her.
She's not calling him an evil man.
No.
She's saying some people might interpret this as evil.
Right.
But he feels justified in his position.
Right.
Because when people do evil things, they feel justified in their position. Whatever evil things they did, they feel like there was a reason for it.
Yeah, and that's so hard.
It's hard, but it's also,
I don't know that I agree with the whole,
it's ignoring character.
It's ignoring willful bad character, too.
Yes.
It's ignoring, but then you get into that, well, where circular logic of mental health is mm-hmm. that's where you kind of get sick. It's like the event horizon to the mental health thing, because then you're like, well, if they're mentally ill, that would be the reason,
uh-huh.
and we should have compassion. But also, are they just mentally ill because they
did this thing?
Bad people and chose to be in, like, terrible individuals and like with intent.
Yeah.
So, who? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's...
Yeah. So you made the face when I said...
oh, yeah.
People don't think that they're bad.
And you're, I went...
Like, yeah. Because a lot of people do think that they're bad.
Yeah.
But Idu Landau, who's a doctor who writes for Psychology Today, said you may not be as bad a person as you think. Because I know a lot of people who think that they are bad, and I know them to be good people. Mm-hmm. So people see their good, kind behavior in the external world as just a pretense. They take themselves to really be evil because sometimes they have bad and aggressive fantasies, thoughts, emotions, and drives. And this they believe shows who they really are. However, many of these self-attributions, evilness is based on wrong presumptions. One presumption that is that what happens inwardly is more indicative of who we quote unquote really are, or our true or authentic self, than how we behave in the world.
Yep. I'm glad that you said this, because you do actually deal with this in mental health, because you deal with it in anxiety disorders, but you also postpartum.
No.
Okay. And pregnancy. We deal with this a lot in that time frame. And it is this inflation of the value of your thoughts and inward thinking over what you actually choose to do. So when you're pregnant, a lot of times you'll have crazy dreams. Right? Like where you've like put a baby in an oven instead of the loaf of bread, or you killed them, or whatever. These are actually very common.
I lost my baby in a dream.
Okay, there you go. So these are common. And then after you have the child, sometimes these flashes of thoughts come through your mind. Now this happens outside of postpartum, but postpartum is an easy one to talk about, because it provides a little bit more meat and context all in one. But you can have like these horrible ideas of like throwing the baby against the wall.
Uh-huh.
Right. Or like, just forget this mess, you know?
And people have it when they drive cars too. Yes. They think about what it would be like to crash the car or drive off the bridge.
Exactly.
And
these are normal. These are actually normal thoughts.
Uh-huh.
The anxiety isn't that you're having the thoughts. The anxiety is that you're concerned about the thoughts.
Right.
Right? And so you've inflated the importance. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad choice you've made. It's just you tend to inflate the value of those passing thoughts. But you don't have to think everything that drops in your head either.
Right.
Right? Like, it can be a passing thought and be like, humans are weird.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I can fully blame GTA for thinking, points! But the drive off the bridge, hitting the button, just setting something on fire, these are all just part of our natural brain functions, and they actually help us like function process. And survive and right. process things.
Yeah.
So but mothers, can you imagine the motherly guilt associated with the idea that when they're crying that you think, I can just toss them off this bridge, right? Well, you don't, just because it flashes does not mean that's who you are.
Right.
But we tend to think you've revealed yourself.
Yeah, no.
It's not true.
No, because your actions in the real world mm-hmm. come from a place of goodness.
Right.
And they are every bit as indicative mm-hmm. as your vile, evil
right.
thoughts that you might have that are completely normal, and mm-hmm. everybody has them.
Right. I mean, and I'm not talking about outside of normal parameters. Obviously,
right.
there's
yeah.
outside of normal parameters.
Right.
But
right.
the other thing about that is a lot of people who make bad choices, who get into impossible situations and then end up making a really bad choice, it is hard to overcome this thinking of the fact that that one choice defines who you are. Very hard to move on from who you were in that moment. It's not that we don't get over the bad choice. It's we don't get over the fact that we could be that person who made that bad choice. So even if you get to the place where you're like, okay, I understand that who I am is better and more important than the sum of like my bad choices.
Right.
But we don't, it's like we can't deal with who that person was. We're not very good at the journey because right. it's not stable. Because if we have to admit that who we were then made bad choices, then we have to admit that we don't really have it all together now.
Yeah.
But it's much more calming to say, oh, I don't know who that person was. I'm not dealing with that person.
Right.
Oh, I can be a bad person and like lock that person up in a closet and then exist as the good person you are now. But if you have to admit that you really were that person and you changed, then you have to admit that you're maybe capable of making a really crappy decision again.
Yeah, I'm capable of changing back, and that's scary. Yes, that's
scary.
Yeah.
But it's so important to know that you, who you are is more than that bad choice.
Yeah.
You know, you're not alone, right? And,
right.
And that's why we help each other out.
Yeah, exactly. Real life.
Real life. Let me what you got.
So $1,000 was a lot of money in 1958.
Okay, yes, please talk to me about this.
Okay, yes.
I didn't do that math. Yeah. Let's be honest.
Oh, I didn't do the math. I went to online calculators. They told me everything I needed to know. So $1,000 in 1958 would have the same amount of buying power as about $9,300 in 2021.
About $10,000?
Yeah. So not too shabby.
And he's paying expenses.
And he's paying expenses. This was just the reward for going. Yeah. But in Italy, that money would have gone even further.
Okay.
In 2021, that would have been about the same amount of buying power as over 23,000 euros.
Ooh.
So it would go a lot further. He definitely, it was pretty lavish.
Yes, it was.
But, I mean, who
lavish
knows?
Lavish then is not the same thing as lavish now.
Right. And Tom stole some of Dickie's money. Mm-hmm. He cashed at least one more $1,000 check.
Oh, at least.
Before Dickie went, quote unquote, missing. At least. And who knows how much he was asking for when it came to those expenses.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean,
well, they bought an icebox.
Yes, an icebox. It was delightful.
It was so
Dickie
precious.
Didn't even want to buy it, and then he loved it so much.
And then he loved it. He was like, cold beer. Uh-huh. It cracked me up, and it was so cute. It was the size of like a dormitory refrigerator.
Yeah, it was. It was adorable. But I think that's normal in Europe.
It is more normal, mm-hmm. but then ice boxes were smaller anyways because they were actually ice boxes.
Yeah, you put ice in the bottom.
Yeah.
Or in the top. I think it was in the bottom so that when it melted, it stayed in the little thing at the bottom. But
oh, yeah.
I think that's what.
I don't know how they work.
My dad, growing up in New Jersey in the early 50s, they had an ice box, mm-hmm. and it was a big deal. The Iceman would come.
Yes.
And bring the, and I think it went in the bottom.
Okay. It's funny because back then he would have had the Iceman, the Milkman, the Oil Man.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm sure they had oil heating. I'm sure.
Yeah. Big they lived tank. In an apartment, so they probably didn't deal
get
with the
deal. Yeah, we did.
Yeah, they didn't deal
that,
with
I hated
the,
that. That was the only thing about living in Boston is the oil delivery. And you would not be there. They'd come in and they hook into the port and they'd, you know, deliver the oil to your furnace, whatever. I'd get home and open the door and be like, they were here today. It was an old house. It should have been more insulated, but nevertheless, I love their little icebox.
So doing an impression of another person is partially an innate gift, but it also can be honed with practice and attention. Tom was very good.
Yes, he was.
At impersonating people because he had an innate talent, but mm-hmm. also because he practiced. So here are some tips if you want to do an impression of someone. Work on mimicking vowels.
Could you be any more like Chandler?
Yeah, exactly.
How you doing?
How you doing? Or like if somebody from Boston.
In Boston.
Uh-huh. And they say the AR combination, mm-hmm. You know, kind of goes, so it's not a car park. It's a car park.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Wicked. Yeah.
That's a
wicked awesome.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Uh-huh. So you might drop syllables from certain things. So people from the South.
Yeah.
In a word that ends with ing, they'll drop off the
G.
The G. No, it's not going.
It's going. Uh-huh. Yeah. We're going.
Uh-huh.
Not we're going.
Or even gonna.
Yeah.
Yeah. It might be.
Fixing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole nother cliche, too, but like fixing to or mm-hmm.
yeah.
trying.
Yes. And those kind of patterns are mm-hmm. things that you should pick up on. So, and you should think about the patterning and the pacing of how a person speaks. So if they tend to, let's say, like Ross, to go back to the whole Friends thing.
Yes.
He has a way of pausing.
So true.
That you would want to pay attention to when if you were going to try and mimic him.
The bagel, the bagel.
Exactly. You want to keep an eye out for facial tics or common expressions that those people make. You know, if you're doing somebody in particular, and practice.
Practice.
In front of a mirror. And just remember, not everyone can do impersonations very well. And not everyone can do every impersonation.
That's true.
If you have a very deep voice, it might be very difficult for you to imitate someone with a very high voice. There's physical limitations for some people. So, you know, that's kind of fun.
That is kind of fun.
Marge got all annoyed with Dickie because he named his boat after one of his favorite jazz pieces, Bird. And it should have been named after a woman. Though I would say Bird is a British word for a lady. So it's not completely out of it.
Right. You
know, they might talk about a bird and they're talking about the girl they met at the pub.
Right. Yeah. So it's close.
It's close enough. So, but I was like, why?
Why are boats and cars girls?
Uh-huh. So I'm going to, there's a, didyouknowboats.com has an article about this.
Ooh.
Some of their reasonings are very sexist.
Okay.
So I'm not going to touch on those very much.
Okay.
I'll bring those up at the end. Males, it's men who own boats, and they'll name them after important women in their lives. That sailors in the past would name their boats after goddesses or mother figures in order to give protection to the ship.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. That totally makes sense.
I can deal with that.
It also kind of comes from the origins of language. So a lot of Indo-European languages have female, male, or neutral words.
Right. Which makes it very hard to learn the language in some ways.
Right. Especially if you're not used to speaking that way.
Right.
And in Latin, the word ship is novice, which is a feminine word.
Oh, okay.
So that would make sense when you go that way. Some of the sexist ones are that men love them, therefore they have to be women. Boats are like mothers.
What? How? How is a boat like a mom?
A sense of nurturing and protection. A ship is likened to a mother taking care of a baby inside her womb.
Okay. Okay. I mean,
whatever. Boats are high maintenance. I have a finger for
that one. I'm much more excited about the men love them because, a lot of men do love women. And so men love them.
Talk about how vessels are comparable to women, that they need a strong hand to keep them in check, which I'm like.
Yeah, I have opinions about that.
Yeah, and I'm just going to put that article off to the side now.
Or else we're going to find ourselves on another trail without a rabbit.
Well, it's interesting that they're, I'm just going to briefly mention this article and put it on, because I highlighted a whole bunch of stuff and I'm like, yeah, that's kind of depressing and sad. Now I'll talk about it all. But Megan Bell wrote an article on readpassage.com. I was born wealthy and I know rich people don't work harder than you, which is interesting. And her little subhead to that, and I'll post the article online. I never saw exceptional hard work or intelligence among the members of the class that I was born into. And yet she goes on to talk about how very classist some of her family members are. And they don't understand that, basically that every job is important, that they just see the people who come in and do the cleaning as disposable.
Aww.
And how frustrating that is for her. Mm-hmm. Somebody born into that situation.
Interesting article.
Yeah, yeah, it was really
good. I'll have to take time to dive in. We have margin for that.
Yeah. Lastly, when Tom and Dickie are drinking those cold beers, they look at Dickie's handwriting. Now, we know that Tom has ulterior motives.
Yes.
To look at this handwriting and really, like, asks Dickie, oh no, write your actual signature. Don't just write your name. Well, because he wanted to study it. But There's also a pseudoscience called graphology. And graphology is the analysis of the physical characteristics and patterns of handwriting with an attempt to identify the writer, indicate the psychological state at the time of writing, or evaluate personality characteristics. No scientific evidence exists to support graphology.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a pseudoscience.
It is a pseudoscience, but it's, you know, I mean, and it was just seemed like they were doing it for fun.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Tom had this ulterior motive, but they were kind of doing it for fun. Oh, look, when you write this way, it says this about you. Mm-hmm. And
I mean, there are some common sense things that have a little bit of support that the like forensics might use. Uh-huh. Like, for instance, we can authenticate handwriting. We can also determine certain types of handwriting. Like, yes, I think this was a rush, mm-hmm. You know, which may or may not be like, it's not like proof. It right. just is another little piece of the puzzle that might help guide those who are detecting and searching and right. things like that, which we know has a little bit of art to it.
Right.
We know these people have a little bit of an instinct. And so when they see something, it helps them, but it's not really...
No, and they say that you really shouldn't confuse this with forensic document yeah, examination. That,
which is
that
a different thing.
It's a completely different thing, but right. this is like, this is more akin to numerology or,
right,
or astrology or reading palms or mm-hmm. something like that.
Yes, yes. It's a kind of different thing. I mean, forensics does have a lot to do with, they can tell a decent amount from some handwriting. And those who are intuitive people can sometimes look at something and go, ooh, I see something.
Uh-huh.
You yeah. know, but that's a whole different world.
Right, right. They're really...
There may be two different worlds. There's right. like those like well, really interesting, insightful people. And then there's like forensics over here.
Uh-huh.
Then there's graphology, yeah. which should be an app on Facebook.
Yeah, it's just... fun.
Yeah.
No, I think that's bad.
I know. I want somebody to look at my handwriting and tell me what it means because it's just oh. chicken scratch.
Yeah.
Your handwriting's pretty.
She's brilliant. Oh, thank you. No, but thank you.
I can read it.
Yeah.
My bar is low. My mother had calligraphy type handwriting. Oh, wow.
My mom has beautiful handwriting too.
Straight.
Yeah.
No lines, just straight.
Wow, that's cool.
Gorgeous. My dad and I write exactly the same.
That's because you're both brilliant.
Aw, thanks. I can copy his signature. I sign his, like when we were out to eat or whatever, uh-huh. I can sign his little credit card. It looks exactly like it.
It doesn't matter. You can draw whatever you want on those.
I can write my own name and it looks just like his, writing his name. That's really funny.
That is funny. Did you ever read that? Next time, you're going to be... away.
I am.
So we're going to have some outtakes episodes.
Woo-hoo!
I'm not exactly sure if it's going to be two or three, but at least a couple. But there's all kinds of good new material that will be super, super fun. And we're going to talk more about The Handmaid's Tale. Oh, and
we have so much stuff on that.
We do have.
Because we could talk about that for ages.
Yes. And the finale was... amazing.
I haven't watched the finale yet. I'm still catching up with the new episodes because it was like chaotic this week. And this is the week I probably would have watched it, but uh-huh. everything went sideways.
Yeah, that's fine.
So I got one episode in this
everything
week.
Everything did go sideways for you.
Talk about giving up AC.
Oh, it was the best Handmaid's Tale episode ever.
Oh, gee whiz, really?
It was so good.
I foresee late nights in my future.
One of the best episodes of any show I've seen this year.
Oh my gosh. Okay, I can't wait. I can't wait.
It's good.
It's been good so far.
Yeah. We'll be back with you real soon. Don't skip those outtakes episodes because they're super fun.
Oh yeah, you don't want to skip that.
No. And until next time, be safe, be kind, and wash your hands.
Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum. Da, 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 da.